The next case this morning is Melchor v. Lewis, or well, however it's pronounced, it's 18-8000.
It pleases the court. My name is Blake Atkin. I represent the appellant in this case, Melchor One, a company that operated a Days Inn in Riverton, Wyoming.
And how do you pronounce the next name? Is it Lewis?
Lewis, Sandy Lewis.
Thank you, counsel.
In her decision granting summary judgment, the trial court made a factual determination that was not even a question of disputed or not disputed. The facts were actually undisputed. It's just that the trial court got the fact wrong. And let me illustrate this. The trial court, in her decision, said, the record establishes as a matter of law, Melchor cannot establish that the city deprived it of a protected right related to renting the existing motel rooms. I'm sure the court, having read the briefs, knows that this is about a renovation that was taking place. There were existing rooms, and then new rooms were being added to the hotel. And she says,
Are those pre-existing rooms grandfathered under the ordinances?
They are. Under the 2006 International Building Code, which had been adopted by Riverton, and it's undisputed that that's the proper code.
Now, it's the additional rooms that did not have the fire suppression system built into them. Is that correct?
Well, there are two questions, Your Honor. There's been talk in this case about a fire suppression system, which is the sprinklers, fire sprinklers.
Right.
And a fire alarm system.
Mm-hmm. Well, those are two different
animals. One's
a horse, one's a camel.
Yes.
So they're two different animals.
They are. And over our objection in the beginning, the city required that fire sprinklers be included in both the existing rooms and the new rooms. We objected to that, but rather than fight it, we added the fire suppression system. So the building as remodeled has a fire suppression system, fire sprinklers throughout.
The addition and the existing building?
Correct. That,
I guess I misread the briefs, but I thought that that's what the issue was here, is that some did not, and that the city wouldn't grant a certificate of occupancy because they didn't have the suppression system.
The building, in fact, has a fire suppression system throughout. We objected to putting it in the existing rooms because of that grandfathering clause that you're talking about. But rather than fight it at that point, we just put in the fire suppression system. What the building does not have is a fire alarm system. And the issue that the court found that is incorrect is that the city cannot establish that the city deprived it of a protected property right relating to renting the existing motel rooms. And let me just show the court
I'm sorry. Well, before we even get to the merits of this case, I'd like to focus on waiver. You're making procedural due process arguments, and the law is that if you don't take advantage of the procedures that are made available, that your claim is waived. Here, your client had 10 days from the adversary decision to bring an appeal, and did not. In fact, it was over 6 months later that the appeal was filed. Why aren't we done with both claims?
I'm getting right to that point, Your Honor, because by deciding that the city had never ordered the closure of the existing rooms, that factually incorrect decision implicated and led to the incorrect analysis that the court later made with respect to that very issue. And let me illustrate.
But whether the court understood or not precisely what the scope of the denial was, you had an adverse decision well before, 6 months before, you filed an appeal.
That's not correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
There was an adverse decision that was made with regard to the new remodel, with regard to getting certificates of occupancy, with regard to the new rooms. That adverse decision happened in August of the year before, saying you didn't show up at the hearing, and therefore we decide that against you.
Okay, just so I'm clear, so do you admit that there's a waiver as to the new rooms?
Oh, there would have been a waiver as to the new rooms with regard to that issue, but not with respect to the existing rooms, the old rooms.
Okay, I'm just trying to separate them out so I can see what you concede. So we have a waiver. We don't need to worry anymore about the new rooms.
I don't believe that that's correct, Your Honor, and here's why. That decision with regard to the new rooms, I don't know on what basis the court would decide that there is a waiver of the issues relating to this hotel when the city later, for the first time, 6 months later, for the first time, tries to apply that ruling to the existing rooms. And for the first time in the history of this interaction between the city and this hotel, orders the closure of the existing rooms. We were entitled to due process.
There was never an order of the closure of the existing rooms. There is no such order.
Let me show you.
And that's what I believe the district court found that. That's the problem. You have to actually, assuming you had a property interest in those rooms, you've got to actually have some kind of adverse action. There was no action.
Well, some kind of adverse action.
I just need you to respond. I don't need to see the district court's opinion.
Excuse me?
I have trouble reading from that angle. It's not helpful.
Your exhibits aren't helpful.
Sorry. I'll just read it. This is out of the appendix.
Yeah, it's better to read it.
It's page 214 of the appendix. Okay. And in this letter, Sandy Luer sends a letter to the hotel and said...
I'm familiar with that letter. Okay. Where do they order closure?
And in the end, she says, if any of these items specified above are not complied with, then you shall cease renting of all rooms.
But they didn't do it. They waited for you to comply. They never did order the closure. They never enforced it. I'd like for you to point me to some case law saying that warning, essentially, if you don't comply, is somehow an actual adverse action that implicates your property interest, assuming you have a protected property interest.
That's factually incorrect that they never took steps to enforce this order. We have in the record the email from the city to my office in which they say, we're going into court next week, into state court next week, to seek an injunction closing the hotel. In this very proceeding, the city sought an injunction to close the motel.
And didn't receive it.
They did not receive it, but they were seeking it. Right. But for this litigation.
Can you point me to some case law that would indicate that that's a denial of their property interest, their due process rights somehow?
The
fact that they were seeking an injunction in this proceeding and didn't get one, that Is there any, I mean, this, am I missing something?
This letter says, if you don't comply with these requirements within 30 days, you will cease renting out rooms. That is an adverse.
May I ask a really stupid question?
There are no stupid questions, know, particularly if you're a federal judge.
I can run over to Costco and buy a little fire alarm and stick it on the ceiling of our bedroom for $15 if I screw it in the ceiling myself. So I take it that this dispute is not about that, about a fire alarm. The suppression system, the expensive thing, pipes and water and all that stuff, that's already in, you tell us.
Correct.
So my stupid question is, how can you possibly justify the cost of litigation and appeal if all it takes is putting a little fire alarm on the ceiling of each of these rooms? Does the ordinance require more than that?
The ordinance doesn't require any alarm system, according to our expert and the architect who designed.
Well, it certainly must, because the city's writing these letters and we're up here arguing about the fire alarm system.
And that is another factual dispute in this case. Our expert, the architect who designed the building, walked through the code and pointed out to the court why this remodel and this existing structure did not need a fire alarm system. He talked about how what the city is calling a corridor is not a corridor, it's an exit passageway, because it is built with 1 hour fire rated walls on all four sides. And so our expert says that this building never needed any kind of fire alarm. The city's person that they designated as an expert, and we took the position that he didn't have the proper qualifications to be an expert, says something different. So that's another factual dispute.
We don't involve ourselves in these kinds of factual disputes unless there is a constitutional interest, you know, right, implicated. And that's what I'm trying to get you to focus on. There not only has to be an interest implicated, there has to be a violation of that interest. And something even more important is the law, federal law, had to be clearly established at the time that violation, that there was a constitutional violation.
Well, and
I don't even see where
clearly,
you allege
the
clearly established federal law.
The clearly established federal law is the right to a meaningful hearing at a meaningful time.
Of course, that's too generalized. That's too generalized under the Supreme Court's case law. You've got to have a much more specific. You've got to point to a specific, more specific case.
We had an,
that the facts in this case established. The law was clearly established.
We had an order from the city saying close the existing rooms. Had we not brought this action,
I understand your allegation. I'm saying, where is the case law that would say that with these facts,
the case law
is clearly established that these officials should have known that their conduct was violating MLCOR's clearly established.
Well, and while you're answering that, where is the policy that you're relying on?
The what?
The policy. You have to have a city policy that, an established policy that was being followed, and you don't allege that in your complaint.
We do. This denial of due process wasn't a rogue cop somewhere. This was the city officials and the city board of appeals and the city council. There's hardly a person standing in Riverton that wasn't involved in the denial of our right to a meaningful hearing at a meaningful time.
I assume you dropped your official policy or your official capacity claims. At least that's what was suggested. I believe that was suggested in the response brief, and you didn't answer that in the reply brief. I didn't see anything about under Monell that there was any official policy or custom. The district court pointed out that you hadn't alleged that.
Under Monell, the court is talking about some rogue official somewhere, not the official city policy of denying you a meaningful hearing at a meeting.
You said you wanted to reserve some time, correct?
I would, Your Honor. Thank
you. It's gone.
May it please the court, counsel Richard Rideout on behalf of the defendants in this case.
Yes, counsel, I'd like to follow up with some of Judge Moritz's questions.
Yes, sir.
Are you going to pursue your injunction further, or the relief that you sought in your injunction further? Are you actually going to try to shut this place down if they don't comply with the terms of your requested injunction?
At this point, Your Honor, it's my understanding that after the injunction was granted in part and denied in part by the judge in February of 2017, that essentially the plaintiffs have shut down the building. It's my understanding they've shuttered up the building. And from that date to current, I'm not aware of any activity going on at that motel.
Well, thank you very much for that information. That's very interesting. But my question is, do you intend, assuming they try to reopen their business, to seek to enforce the terms of the letter that Judge Moritz was pointing out has not actually been enforced so far? Are you going to seek enforcement?
Your Honor, it's still the city's position that because of the configuration of this motel, that they need to comply with the International Building Code Section 970.2.8.1. Now, and so the answer would be yes.
So you do.
They would.
So Judge Moritz's questions become more than theoretical, because as I understand the predicate of her question, it is, hey, what are you seeking relief from? They haven't enforced it, and you're saying we're going to keep trying to enforce it.
They will enforce it if they attempt to open the motel, because it's their
next question, which was my stupid question, and that is the cost of complying with your interpretation of the code. Is it just simply a matter of rather de minimis cost of putting up individual alarms, or is this some highly complicated, expensive system?
It's my understanding, Your Honor, that the International Building Code requires more than simply independent smoke alarms and smoke detectors in rooms, that there has to be a unified or central system to alert people, to alarm people, to notify the people staying in the motel and the owners of the motel or the managers on duty that there's an issue. So
was the existing hotel grandfathered?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, and here's why. The appellants have always, they refer to this as a remodel, but which makes it sound like they went in and painted the old rooms and added some new rooms on it, but that isn't really a fair characterization. The change in the building was complete. As it existed prior to the construction, every sleeping room had an external door that exited out into a public way. So it was open. There was no interior corridors or hallways. So you would go up to the motel, check in, drive your car over, and the doorway would be right there. Under the building code, buildings that are two stories or less in height, that have direct external exits to a public way, are not required to comply with the fire suppression and alarm system.
Nor are buildings that go into an exit passageway that has particular fire suppression construction. That's correct, right?
Well, and then I think you get back to the issue.
Right, first answer, that's correct, right?
Right, what's a passageway?
So, what's an exit passageway? I mean,
right.
Reasonable people could disagree under this building code what an exit passageway is, couldn't they?
I would not stand in front of this court and tell you that the International Building Code is a model of clarity.
I would concur.
Right.
But that the court basically said that it was clear. I think that your opponent may be correct, that there would have been an issue of fact there that a jury could have decided whether they did or didn't comply.
Well, that kind of brings us back full circle to the beginning of of the argument.
And this isn't some ma and pa, to follow up on Judge McHugh's question, some ma and pa operation that doesn't have an architect. The architect said that his plans complied with that requirement, and by the way, you approved the plans.
Yes, Your Honor.
Did you not? Didn't the city approve the architect's
plans? City did approve the plans.
Thank you.
So under Snake River Venture versus Board of County Commissioners, by issuing the building permit, did that create a property interest in a certificate of occupancy?
No.
Okay, and why not?
There is no case law that says that you have a vested interest in an unissued certificate of occupancy. Snake River involved only a building permit. There was a change in the zoning up in Jackson, up in Teton County in between, and the permit, the building permit initially issued, was later determined to be invalid under that new zoning ordinance. And in passing, the court made reference to Annatoo on municipal government, saying there's no vested right in a building permit unless there's substantial completion and reliance upon that permit.
And wouldn't that reasoning apply to a certificate of occupancy? I mean, it's great that you said I could build my hotel, but if you don't let anyone occupy it, it seems to me I'm suffering the same injury to my property interest.
The issues are significantly different. A building permit is simply a permission granted by the authority having jurisdiction to build the structure. And during that time, they require that you build it according to whatever codes or zoning ordinances or state statutes are applicable. And in this case, they listed all of those, including the International Building Code. A certificate of occupancy requires that you have complied with that. And it's done for the important aspect of making sure that this motel is safe and it complies with the code. That's the best standard you have for determining whether or not a building is safe.
But apropos the last question, the situation here is that the architect had submitted plans that had been approved with respect to the existing structure as to whether any modifications, further modifications, were going to be required. And they, in fact, put in a suppression system, even though they may not necessarily have had to do so.
It's true, Your Honor, that they put in the suppression. I disagree that they didn't have to do it. I think they did have to do it.
But the building permit listed, it required a suppression system, but not an alarm system.
It required.
It doesn't mention an alarm system at all.
And it required that they comply with the code.
Right.
And the code does require.
Well, we just decided there's an issue of fact on whether the code requires that, because we don't know what an exit passageway is despite considerable efforts to figure it out.
Well,
when there's an issue of fact, which there probably are frequently about what a building code requires, and there's probably disagreement frequently, what turns that issue of fact into a constitutional violation?
And
where's the clearly established law? And I didn't see that you really argued that, but don't we have an obligation to consider that, even though you didn't necessarily pinpoint yourself the failure?
And I think that loops me back to what my first point was going to be, which is the court needs to keep focus on what really is important here and what the claim is that he made in his amended complaint in March of 2017. And he asserted four causes of action, if you break it out, individual and official capacity.
Are the official waived? I mean, I thought they were still in, but Judge Morris thinks they're out. So
There's nothing in the appellant's opening brief that addresses the official capacity.
I didn't see anything.
And there's nothing in the appellant's brief that addresses the substantive due process claim. So what you're essentially left with after, I think, the appellant has waived those two, is a procedural due process claim against the individuals. And a procedural due process claim, in order for the plaintiff to succeed, he has to prove first that there's a protected property interest in that certificate of occupancy, because that's the issue that he complained about all through there. There is no case law that supports that holding. And I found none, and I don't believe that the the appellant has found any. Second of all, he didn't contest whether or not the process provided, the process that was in place, was somehow constitutionally defective.
Let's talk about that process, because you, as I understand it, it's a little confusing, because at first the city says, well, they get his appeal 6 months later, and the city says, well, it's not timely.
Yes.
You have 10 days from the date of the decision, which presumably the date of the decision was the letter that you sent, not the oral statement made by the inspector. But in any event, 6 months runs, and you say it's not timely. But then you offer a hearing, and I'm confused as to what that hearing was going to be. And my understanding is that the plaintiff's counsel asked for the hearing to be continued. You continued the hearing, and then he didn't show up for the continued hearing. So I guess I'm wondering if you had a determination that the appeal was untimely, what was the hearing going to be about? About the timeliness of the appeal?
Well,
or was it going to be a full evidentiary type hearing?
My understanding is it was simply to determine whether or not the process was followed, whether it was a timely appeal, whether it was done on the proper application form, and whether it was verified.
So there would have been a hearing on the city's determination that essentially the notice of appeal was not timely.
Right.
And he requested a continuance of that hearing, but didn't show up on the continued date.
Correct, Your Honor. Correct.
What about his second appeal?
Pardon?
His second appeal.
Yes. He did file an appeal from this letter that you've seen there, February 5th.
And in his, that was denied as untimely, saying it's just part and parcel of the first appeal. His claim, as I understand it today, is that, no, this is different because this is the first time that I was appealing your decision to close down the existing rooms. Can you respond to that?
Well, the city did let them lease the new rooms during the pendency on the representation that they would install the fire suppression and alarm system. And they represented that they would, and they did. But they never have gone back and gotten a certificate of occupancy. So the city's decision to let them do that, really, frankly, they didn't need to do that. And
so if they come back now, then the city will give them the certificate of occupancy?
I don't think you can grandfather somebody into to compliance with a safety and health and safety regulation.
Well,
I think that would be bad policy.
I didn't ask whether they'd be grandfathered on that, but I thought you said that the city had said that if they would install the systems, plural, that they would allow them to occupy the property. Did you
Correct.
Say that? And so my question is, does that mean that if they now come back and ask for a certificate of occupancy, that you will give it to them?
I believe that's true. And what happened was, after the judge granted in part and denied in part the equitable relief requested, one of the things that Judge Friedenthal did was say, city, you go and inspect the property again if they request that you do that, and here's what you need to do. And so on the 17th of February, I contacted the plaintiff's lawyer, the appellant's lawyer, and told him that the city inspectors would go out on March 8th and inspect the property. And if it's in compliance...
Or compliance on these two systems.
Well, it would have to be on everything. Are we now opening up a new... But that was the only issue.
All right.
That we would give them a certificate of occupancy, and I never heard back from them. They never contacted the city.
So then, because ultimately we are in the business of resolving disputes, so we don't really have a dispute here. If the appellants will come back now and ask for a certificate of occupancy on these two points, you're going to grant it.
I think it would have to be granted if they comply.
So what's the dispute? Well, we'll get a chance to ask your opposing counsel in a minute.
Well, in summary, Your Honor, I think one of the things that's important to keep in mind, Judge Moretz has mentioned it several times, this is a procedural due process claim. There has to be an underlying constitutional deprivation. The plaintiff has never established that. the procedure that was set up by the city to appeal these decisions is the means by which the substantive decisions to review building codes and to determine whether it's an exit way passage or a corridor is set up already. The alternative to that is this court reviewing the decision of every building inspector in the circuit to find out whether or not it's in compliance.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And you may or may not have had some time left. I'm not sure if we were going up or down at the point, but go ahead. I want to ask you a question. You heard the last questions and answer. Why don't we just abate this case just a short while you folks go out and
first do it
the way we did in my country practice. Just you guys go out and settle this. Why can't you do that?
We tried that several times, Your Honor. At this point, because we didn't have a meaningful hearing at a meaningful time, we've lost the property. We do not control the property. The bank has taken over the property.
Oh, my goodness.
Answering your question about...
So you don't even have the property anymore.
We do not. We have this damage claim is all that's left to us.
Wow.
Answering your question about the cost, if I could take a couple of minutes to do that, we could never get a straight answer from the city what needed to be done here. They said, go get an architect, get a signed drawing, and so we tried to do that. But here's the real problem. We had a rough-in inspection. That's before you put the sheetrock in, before you put the carpets in, before you paint the walls, you ask them, is there anything else that needs to be done? They came and recognized that there was no alarm system. The electrical subcontractor who was in charge of that said, these plans have never called for an alarm system. End of story. They didn't do anything else. Now, in their briefing, they say, oh, we had a right to amend the drawings if we found that they didn't comply with the building code. There was never any attempt to amend the drawings. Had they done that before the rough-in inspection or at the rough-in inspection, we could have simply cost-effectively put in an alarm system, whatever they would have required at that point. They didn't. The language also says they have a right to stop us from building if we're violating the code. They didn't red tag this project. They sat there and watched us put in the sheetrock, watched us put in the carpet, watched us paint the walls, and then when we said, give us a final inspection, they said, oh, you don't have a fire alarm system. And that wasn't the first time they'd done that. All through this building process would get... We had foundations poured, and they pulled it back and said, move the wall. We had the people there to hook up the water system.
Life is frustrating sometimes, counsel, and even more so today because your time is up.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Thank you very much.